The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. In just a few weeks, Governor Sununu will present his proposed budget to the state legislature. It's a biennial event that got us wondering, how is a state budget created? Who pulls out the calculator and crunches the numbers? How much does it change throughout the budget process? And where is the money going? For answers, we're turning to something new here at NHPR, a local offshoot of our popular Civics 101 podcast, but this one focused all on New Hampshire. It's called Civics 101 New Hampshire, and it'll be your place to ask questions about how our state, county, local governments work. What's the executive council? How does the governor's office work? We're here to answer all of your questions. Up first, we're tackling the state budget.
Money is sexy. But the word budget?
The New Hampshire legislature is about three quarters of the way through the current session, and there are cuts in the state budget.
Budget reeks of responsibility.
This budget suspends.
Even if I tried to drown it in Axe body spray, the word budget would still be off-putting. But today, you're going to hear that budgets could be drop-dead gorgeous, or at least worth checking out.
Some are calling it a doomsday budget for the New Hampshire Department of Transportation.
The New Hampshire operating budget is such a large, hairy beast.
Cut the budget almost immediately.
The bottom line is public safety. People would die.
We had to cut it up into two separate parts.
This is Civics 101 New Hampshire. We are digging into the state budget. In part one, Jackie Hilbert tears apart the budget. What is it? Who writes it? And how does it get passed?
To help us get to the bottom of how it all works, we enlisted the help of Citizens Count, a nonpartisan group that provides information about things like issues, bills, and politicians. They make it easy for New Hampshireites to get involved.
The budget is important to understand because it's how we set our priorities.
Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
Marijuana legalization is a huge issue that's coming up, and it's all about the dollar signs. What's the cost of enforcement? What's the cost, the revenue we can get from the taxes? My name is Anna Brown. I'm Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, which means I'm kind of a political wonk. I follow all the bills. I profile all the legislators.
Do you have any fun facts about yourself?
Oh, we've got some fun facts.
Oh, girl, there's some really fun facts. You know what fun fact I'm going to pull out.
You better.
I am also an amateur MMA fighter.
And I am Jacqueline Benson, and I am the editor of Citizens Count. I am a historical fiction writer.
The New Hampshire state budget is a document that's rich with policy.
If the legislature decides this year, listen, it's a priority. We need to be providing more money to these struggling schools. They got to find that money somewhere. That's the budget. You know, the budget is what will dictate where that falls in terms of policy.
Funding for special education, transportation, and food services are in question, along with teacher and staff jobs.
We have no idea right now where we stand, and we're being asked or being told that we're looking at 50 teacher layoffs. This is just making my stomach turn.
Michelle Parker, an educator in the Timberlane School District since 1997, stepped in front of a packed school board meeting to say she is not being offered a letter to return. Essentially, she's been pink slipped.
I'm also one of the many who are not being offered a letter of agreement for the upcoming school year.
Because there's going to be a ton of other things that are all competing for this money. Mental health, addiction services. You've got a finite amount. Where are you going to spend it?
So how much money does New Hampshire have?
The two-year budget for the last biennium, I think, was like 11.5 total.
11.7 billion.
I pulled that out the top of my head.
That's around $6 billion a year. Because New Hampshire is a high-maintenance little thing and has a biennial budget.
The biennial budget, that means we do a budget every 2 years. So we do the budget in the off year after the election.
We are one of only four states that still proudly have a biennial budget.
This is Jean Shaheen.
Not only does her poetic name roll off the tongue, but Jean Shaheen also has a stellar resume.
Right now, I'm the senior U.S. Senator from New Hampshire. That means longest serving. Before that, I was the governor from 1997 to 2003. And before that, I was in the state Senate from 1991 to 1997.
Jean Shaheen has seen how the sausage gets made.
Coming up with a spending plan for the state of New Hampshire. Certainly not glamorous, but it's definitely important to the economic health of the state. But the task is not easy.
In phase one, every agency within the government creates its own state budget requests. They have to predict how much money they'll need as far as 3 years into the future. Agencies making requests for funding include the Board of Economic Development, the Board of Dental Examiners, and my favorite, the Board of Registration of Funeral Directors and Embalmers.
Let's turn to our agenda. First item on our agenda is number one, the acceptance of
the agency heads, so people working under the governor,
the big dogs,
are going to come to the governor and they're going to say, okay, there are two options here. Here's the budget that is exactly what we need to keep operating. And here's the budget we would like to really do our job better.
Mixed martial artist Anna Brown.
And you can imagine that's going to be a little more money.
Thursday, Concord budget writers heard from more than a dozen agency heads who collectively have already submitted a wish list totaling $12.7 billion. That's more than 20% higher than the last budget.
I was surprised by how short the agency hearings are. The Boxing and Wrestling Commission got 15 whole minutes, while the Office of the Child Advocate got 5. Altogether, the last state budget requests were 4,435 pages long. That's as big as a page count for the entire Harry Potter series, plus the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of lines of just dollar signs.
A real page-turner. It's now the governor's responsibility to comb through every single line of the request and craft a spending plan. For me, that would be a total deal-breaker. But Jean Shaheen is into it.
Because you originate the budget, you have a chance to at least put down the draft that people work from.
Those requests total far more than our taxpayers and our economy can afford.
Governor has already told them to try again.
The governor isn't holed up underground all alone polishing their precious budget. They have an entire office of experts who are also polishing the budget, the budget office.
Here's one really important thing that does set New Hampshire apart from many other states. New Hampshire, you have to have a balanced budget. So you cannot say, we're going to borrow this money, we think this money will be here, we're going to bet against the future. If you are looking to spend money, you have to say exactly where the money is coming from.
Where does New Hampshire's money come from? Well, a lot of different places.
New Hampshire is home to 11 Powerball and hundreds of Megabucks jackpot winners.
Some Granite Staters are opening up their property tax bills this week, and they're doing a double take.
The New Hampshire Liquor and Wine Outlet's new superstore, Route 3, Exit 6, Nashua, New Hampshire.
That's the deal.
Jackie Benson historical fiction writer.
We can't take out a loan. We can't go into debt to fund something in the budget, and that's in our state law. So if they ever wanted to change that, they'd have to change the law.
At last, the 4,000-ish pages that the governor started with has now been condensed down into 800-ish pages, which is the page count of only the first three Harry Potter books. Good job, guys.
Thank you. Great to see everyone here, braving the elements. This budget proposes...
It's unveiled in the televised state budget address. There are TV cameras everywhere, adoring lawmakers standing up and clapping.
Thank you.
Must-see TV.
At that point, the governor doesn't have any say anymore. Yep. At that point, it's in the hands of the legislature.
Specifically 800 hands. They're attached to the members of the House of Representatives.
Just like any other piece of legislation, it is a bill. It goes through the legislative process like any other. How a bill becomes a law is how a budget becomes a law. There are special steps in this process, but at the end of the day, it's a bill. And it has to be voted on and approved by the legislature and signed by the governor, just like any other bill.
The clock is ticking. The House is on a shorter deadline. The governor had 5.5 months to polish, but the House only has a month and a half to create their own version. Unlike the governor, they don't have their own budget staff. They don't even have their own desks.
First item on our agenda is number one, the acceptance of minutes of the June 26th.
The budget bill starts racing through a maze of committees. The House of Ways Committee, Finance Division 1 Committee, Finance Division 2 Committee. The committees hold their own hearings with the agency heads. The big dogs, again, explain what they need to keep operating and what they would like to do their jobs better. This next step is something that makes the Granite State not extra, but extra special.
You know, one of the things that we have in our legislature that I think is very important for our citizens is every bill that's introduced in the legislature gets a hearing. You can't, as in some states, the leadership or the committee can't decide, well, we're not going to have a hearing on this. We're not going to give the public a chance to have input. And I think that's really an important part, not just of putting together the budget for the state, but of how we deal with issues in New Hampshire.
You, as an ordinary member of the public, can show up in front of the House Finance Committee, in front of the Senate Finance Committee, and have your personal opinion about this, whatever it is you're passionate about that you think we should or shouldn't be spending our money on, you can go there and you can have your say.
One of the things that I can remember having a big impact on the budget process was there were efforts to cut funding for the disabilities community. And that community turned out in great numbers.
That's hurting the disabled community, it's hurting the mental health community.
And convinced legislators that that was not what we should be doing, cutting funding for their needs.
That's a significant pain enough in the budget phase, in my opinion.
The House Finance Committee passes it to the full House of Representatives. Do you like me? Check yes or no. Check yes.
At that point, the budget then goes to the full House of Representatives for a vote.
Just like any bill.
Just like any bill. The House is going to vote on that. They might make a couple changes on the floor. It's usually a really long voting day when the budget comes to the floor because a lot of legislators are going to get really up in arms about what they want to spend on. But at the end of the day, it'll pass.
This is a great win for the state of New Hampshire. This budget will do a lot of good things.
Keep in mind, the budget that the House passed could be nothing like what the governor handed them.
And then it goes to the Senate.
Specifically, the 48 hands of the senators.
And the whole process starts all over again.
Mm-hmm. Like it's stuck in a time loop.
So the Senate Finance Committee is going to do the same thing. They're going to look at the budget.
First item on our agenda is number one.
They're going to hold public hearings. Any member of the public can come. Agency heads can come and give their opinion. The governor can show up and give his opinion. Anybody. We're all equal on that Senate floor. Then the Senate Finance Committee will make their recommendation, what they think the budget should look like.
Turning now to fiscal.
And once again, although there's some wild cards sometimes, what happens when you put it on the floor, a majority of the Senate will vote to pass.
We now stand adjourned.
When the smoke finally clears, we're looking at two different budget proposals, a Senate budget and a House budget. Neither can live while the other survives.
The challenge is not Democrats versus Republicans. The challenge is the House versus the Senate. You do have to compromise because you want to get a budget. You want to keep the government operating.
So the House and Senate have to agree. The way they do this is they set up a committee of conference. That's a selection of House of Representatives members and Senate members. They'll come together in a committee and they'll hash out what they think the budget should be. That final document, the conference committee budget, will once again get a vote from the full House and the full Senate.
They all have to agree.
And then it goes back to the governor.
Back into the two hands that lovingly shaped it. All it needs now is one of those hands to give it a teeny tiny signature.
Before officially giving the thumbs up to the budget agreement, a sign that it was done came in the form of a few congratulatory handshakes from the governor.
We don't want to count our chickens before they're hatched here, but I am very encouraged by the compromise and the collaboration.
But this is politics. The governor doesn't have to sign it.
I am here this morning to reiterate my intention to veto the fiscally irresponsible Republican budget.
They have veto power.
For whatever reason, maybe they don't think that there's going to be enough revenue to match what the budget is spending on. Maybe they oppose some of the priorities.
As you do the math, you know that you don't have the money in the bank account to actually pay for services at the level that this budget says it's paying for.
The governor can't line veto a budget, which means they can't say nope on a specific purchase. It's either veto the entire budget or veto nothing. Live free or die.
Then it's up to the legislature to pass a temporary spending bill while they scramble to figure out what they're going to do. Usually they'll just keep on spending at levels from the previous 2 years, and then they'll gather later in the summer or the early fall to either override the governor's veto or pass another revised budget.
Yeah, Tom, for a while there, it sure seemed like this budget battle was destined to head into the summertime, but at roughly 3 a.m. this morning, a tentative deal was struck by lawmakers, and after a couple of hours sleep, they were back at it this morning to wrap it all up.
If a budget can't be passed, then the government will shut down. But that's not really something to worry about. New Hampshire has a good track record. The last time anything that dramatic happened was around 1960.
Everybody didn't get everything they wanted. All of us are going to walk away with some little piece that we're disappointed in. But on the whole, I think all of us walk away with something we can be proud of.
Perhaps the biggest challenge, Medicaid expansion.
The whole budget writing process takes a year. So you have a year of writing the budget, and then 1 year where maybe we get other things done, I suppose, and then it's all over again.
It's an enormous task. It's an enormous task.
What we decide to spend our money on, mental health care, education, children's advocacy, or wrestling, is a direct reflection of our values as people and as the Granite State.
That's M-O-N-E-Y, so sexy, I...
So now we know how a budget is created, but what's in it?
There's no good way to ask someone else for money, you know? Unless you're the governor of New Hampshire, in which case, every 2 years, you give a speech, and that's what you do. You ask the state legislature for some money.
Good morning,
Madam Speaker, Mr. Senate President.
The state of New Hampshire spends about $5 or $6 billion every year, which is a lot of money, but you would be surprised how fast it goes.
My fellow citizens,
this budget provides level funding to school districts.
This budget puts 15 more troopers on the road.
We are going to double grants for towns, roads, and bridges.
Now, the governor gets to make this big speech, and let's be honest, the way they talk about it, you might think they are the ones who make all the big decisions.
New Hampshire stands at the threshold of a bright new future.
Truth is, not really.
This is Civics 101 New Hampshire. Last episode, we talked about how the state budget gets made. In part two, Ben Henry takes a closer look at exactly what it is we spend that money on and why.
The people who really make the hard decisions about the budget are people like Cindy Rosenwald.
Hi.
Hi, where are you right now?
I'm in my car. I'm on 93, heading south back to Nashua.
Rosenwald lives in Nashua and reps the 13th District in the New Hampshire Senate. Before that, she was in the House on the Finance Committee.
So I was on the Finance Committee for 4 terms.
After the governor gives their speech and gets the applause, Rosenwald is one of the few people who actually sit down and read the budget. They only have about 5 weeks to go through it all. So, like, reading the budget must take forever. Are you, like, taking this thing home and reading it in bed at night?
Yes, exactly. My husband would make fun of me because I'd be propped up in bed with a couple of budget books. We pulled all-nighters, which I hadn't done since college.
Are you asking yourself questions like, is this a responsible use of taxpayer money? Like, is that what's on your mind?
That's one of the questions, sure. What was hardest for me was my first term on the Finance Committee.
It was 2011, the recession. They chose to cut funding to nursing homes. She got calls about it.
Those phone calls were really hard because I had a mother. She was in her 90s. So I understood what the life of a very old person can be like.
New Hampshire has a smaller budget than most states per capita. It's not just recession years. Every year, the budget is tight.
You have to make hard choices.
Yeah.
But you do the best you can.
Today, our tour guides to the state budget are going to be our friends at Citizens Count, a nonpartisan source for civic information in New Hampshire.
My name is Anna Brown, and I'm Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. So I read and summarize the 1,000 bills that go through and try to make them understandable.
You might remember Anna from last episode. She's the one who spends a lot of time reading bills, also an amateur MMA fighter.
And I am Jacqueline Benson, and I am the editor of Citizens Count. So I track about 100 New Hampshire policy issues over the course of the year.
In her spare time, Jackie writes swashbuckling historical fiction. So let's just start big picture. Overall, when we're looking at the budget, what are the main things that we're spending the most dollars on?
So over half of the money we're spending on goes to two areas. Health and social services, which is going to include things like Medicaid. And then the other big one is education. So that's primarily funding for all the schools across the state. And other social services. So, for example, services for people with developmental disabilities.
So that's more than half. And then what's the rest of the money? What are some of the big players that are soaking up money?
Well, things like the court system, paying for the court system.
And you're talking paying like the salary of judges?
Judges, public prosecutors.
The whole system.
Keeping the buildings up and running.
Yeah. You know, yeah. It's a whole branch of government. Yeah. So
they're busy. State police are in there. Then we have the fish and game activities. So resource protection, state parks, you know, managing.
I used to think of the state government as like the mom and pop version of the real government, the federal government. Turns out it's not a small operation.
I'm looking at the budget from last year right now, and it is 840 pages long.
How much do you think the state spends on its phone bill? $14 million. Out-of-state travel? $4 million. Heat and electricity? $31 million. Health and retirement benefits for employees? $360 million. If you want to get these numbers about how the budget is allocated, they're not just written down in that huge document. You got to crunch the numbers yourself. The state publishes a big old spreadsheet of the budget, so I went in there, did some addition. About 10% of the entire 2018 budget just pays the salaries of government employees. Fun fact, those employees were paid $26 million in overtime pay in 2018. That's a lot of overtime, and I respect the hustle. Okay, so those numbers were from 2018. But how about the next budget, or the one after that?
It's going to change from year to year. You heard a lot in the last budget was about addiction services. I think that we will hear about that again this year. But you didn't hear quite as much about the education funding in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And now that's definitely going to be on the agenda this time around.
And these agencies are just trying to survive on the limited revenue they have. So you'll see the budget numbers might go up a little bit, but they'll stay pretty level.
Or things that just become screaming priorities. We've got, you know, a lot of red-listed bridges, the bridges mm-hmm. that need really intensive intervention.
Legislators have to focus on those pressing issues of the day, the crumbling bridges. But the little changes that they make every 2 years add up in the long run. If you look back 20 years ago, the budget was about two-thirds the size it is today. Every year, it gets a little bigger, although during the recession, overall spending went down, and it still hasn't recovered. For example, the amount we spend on education is still declining, whereas the amount we spend on social services and healthcare, that has bounced back to where it was before the recession. And we're not the only state that spends a ton on healthcare. Nationwide, the cost of healthcare has skyrocketed.
So the biggest dollar sign that you're going to see in the healthcare budget is Medicaid.
Medicaid. Basically, if you don't make very much money, if your income is below a certain level, the government will pay for things like doctor visits, surgeries, medication, things like that. The cost of Medicaid is split between the federal and state governments. Another big chunk of that healthcare spending is mental health care.
And for a long time, mental health was kind of put on the back burner because we had a lot of other things going on. In 2008, state revenue crashed with the economy, and we still needed to do things like pay for schools, give students an education. And it was actually a lawsuit that brought mental health back to the forefront.
It's one thing to say, here's all these agencies and they've told us what they want and we're going to meet their needs, and that's great. But when you have to start deciding who's going to get cut, that's often where the individual values of particular legislators are going to come into play.
Cutting the budget, that's just part of the budget process. And New Hampshire is known as a pretty fiscally conservative state. But it is possible to go too far. Legally speaking, some federal laws require the state government to pay for certain stuff. Like the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, we have to make sure public buildings are accessible for everyone. And if they're not, we have to pay for the upgrades. The New Hampshire Constitution also requires the government to pay for certain things, which is a lot of rules to follow. And state lawmakers don't always follow them. And that is when the lawyers get involved.
That's what put the women's prison on the agenda. We got sued because the women, you know, the female prisoners said that their treatment wasn't equal to male prisoners, and the courts agreed.
The state just built a brand new women's prison. Something similar happened with education funding. Schools in New Hampshire used to be funded at the local level, so wealthy towns could pay for good schools, while other towns could not. And that was a problem.
Because the New Hampshire Constitution says that the state is supposed to provide an adequate education.
A couple of towns lawyered up.
They took the state to court, and they said, you're not doing your job. You need to be making sure that we can afford to educate our children.
The towns won that lawsuit. You know how we spend all that money in the state budget on education? Yeah, that's not because of the legislature making a spending choice. It came from a different part of democracy at work. It was the people taking the government to court and winning. So, if you're writing a budget, you got to put out fires. You need to pay for the programs that are straight up falling apart. And you've got to fulfill the core constitutional rights of your citizens. Behind every state constitution, there's got to be a little bit of cash. That responsibility is not lost on Cindy Rosenwald, the representative from Nashua.
Well, it feels good to go back to my community and say we were able to get some state aid to pay Nashua back for water and sewer upgrades.
That's the unglamorous life of a state legislator. When your town gets reimbursed for a sewer upgrade, pretty exciting.
Up next, a story from Outside In about an invasive species that also happens to be pretty darn tasty.
not every scientist has the luxury of working with a subject that they like.
Brat.
Gabby Brandt is a scientist with the University of New Hampshire, and that was the sound of her detaching a green crab that had vice-pincered itself onto the flesh between her thumb and pointer finger.
See, they're mean.
Yeah, defensive stance.
Yeah.
Very intimidating.
Yeah, and the females are actually meaner, I feel.
Up here in the Northeast, green crabs are absolutely everywhere. They look just like your standard beachy tide pool-y crab, but they're green. They're from Europe, but have been on the east coast of the United States for 200 years. They've invaded Australia, South Africa, the west coast of the US, and South America. In other words, they're now on 5 of the 7 continents.
They find a nice niche, they outcompete everything else, they ruin everything they see, they're mean, and they take over. Up in Maine, they completely decimated the softshell clam population up there and caused like millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of loss in income.
Yeah, they just sound like they're the worst.
They are. They're the worst ever.
However, as you and I and anybody who likes seafood is aware, crabs are delicious.
No other species can defeat them.
They're invasive.
So why don't we just freaking eat them?
Because we're hungry.
Eat the invaders.
This is Outside In, and today is our occasional segment about eating invasive pest species. Gabby's quest to eat green crabs began several years ago when a friend of hers from Louisiana pointed out, hey, y'all have a crab problem? Why not eat them into submission? Have you ever tried a softshell crab?
So that started me on that project of, let's try and figure this out.
Softshells, by the way, are in fact just regular crabs. But crabs have an exoskeleton which they have to shed as they grow. It's called molting. And for a few days after they molt, their whole body is soft and you can eat the whole dang thing. So here's a quick explanation of why we eat the crabs that we do at the local Jack Black Crab and Tackle Shack.
Can you just introduce yourself?
Yeah. I'm Brendan Vesey at Joinery Restaurant in Newmarket.
As a fisher, you don't go out trying to catch crabs that have just molted in the day or so before their shells harden back up again. You catch them when they're not soft and then watch for signs that they're about to molt.
But a soft crab, this would be a perfect little starter.
When it's a blue crab, the American crab that most of our soft shells are, as the crab grows, the plates in its shell start to spread apart and show a dark outline around the edge of each one. It's really obvious, and fishers call them busters, as in they're about to bust out of their shell.
So let me just lay them right in the skillet.
Once you find a buster, you separate it out into its own cage, jokingly called a crab condo, so that when it molts, the other crabs don't tear it to pieces. And then you check it every day, because as soon as it molts, you've got to get that sucker to a restaurant or a market while it's still soft.
Yeah, we're just going to get some of the extra grease off.
This taste test at the Joinery was actually about a year ago with former producer Logan Shannon.
It's really good. It's weird because it's like I'm putting a crab in my mouth, but then the time it gets in your mouth is so soft that it sort of like just dissolves. It's seafoody.
I think they have an intensely crabby flavor, which is why we like making the stock for the soup, because I think it tastes stronger than other crab flavor.
I would eat a lot of these.
They are delicious, and people will pay top dollar for them. But the whole process of getting a softshell crab is premised on being able to identify the crabs that are about to molt. And Gabby Brandt realized that nobody had any idea what to look for in these green crabs. So she caught a bunch of them and sent them to her friend's lab down in Louisiana to be monitored. They were looking for morphological changes, physical changes that one was about to molt.
And my colleague down there had it in her tank for, 4 or 5 months, and she got one to molt.
So there goes year one. Year two, they decided to keep the crabs in their own tanks and take constant pictures of them every day so that they could study the molting process. They started by trying to trap 50 males and 50 females. This plan immediately met headwinds because they couldn't find any male crabs.
Because it was the wrong season. We only found females. So we're like, well, that's weird. And then And then we took many, many, many pictures, and we got one molt again.
Turns out, the females really only molt in the late summer. So, another year gone. Year three. Trapped a bunch of females, this time in the right time of year.
And we got 80% of all of our females to molt because we were in the correct time, correct temperature. Awesome. Took pictures. We have a timeline when we caught them to the day they molted. And we went back and looked for morphological characteristics and oh, nothing.
I've joked that this Eat the Invaders segment rarely offers good solutions to the problems of invasive species. But green crabs are very easy to catch. They come up in traps by the hundreds sometimes. So I can imagine a world where there are enough overlapping markets, crab as bait, crab eggs, crab mulch, crab compost, to support enough of a green crab fishery to knock the population back. But to really get fishers interested, to really get them hauling up crabs in huge quantities off the seafloor where they're causing so much trouble, it would be nice to have a high-end market. Something like soft-shell crabs, which can sell for $20, $30, $40 a pound. Compare that to lobster, which floats between $6 and $12 a pound. But Gabby had tried to use the scientific method to come up with clues about the molting process, and no dice. That is, until...
an acquaintance of mine came to me, and so that's sort of what sparked it all.
This is Marissa McMahon, a scientist from Maine that works with a nonprofit called the Manomet Center.
I grew up here. My family are all fishermen from this area, and so I've really been immersed in fisheries, commercial fisheries, my whole life.
She was studying and working on fisheries science in college, but hadn't ever been much interested in the green crab problem, even though she saw the impacts of it all the time.
They're a species that is incredibly well adapted to so many different environments. They can withstand high temperatures, low temperatures. They can actually, there's a study that just came out from some researchers on the West Coast that actually found that they can absorb nutrients through their gills, so they don't even have to eat. I mean, they can go extended periods of time without eating and be fine. It's wild. So, and they're aggressive and they're a voracious predator.
Marissa had this acquaintance, a guy who happened to be a fine arts conservator who spent a lot of time in Venice, like Venice, Italy.
And he was in Venice and he was eating deep-fried soft-shell green crabs. And so he came to me and said, why aren't we doing this here?
What's the Italian name for soft-shell crabs?
It's molecche.
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 This...
Hi, everyone. I'm Paolo.
...is Paolo Tagliapietra.
I'm from Venice. And I'm a fisherman.
I talked to him on WhatsApp. It's a little bit boggling to think about this, but green crabs invaded America in 1817. So it was 199 years from that date before Western scientists first became aware of the fact that the invasive scourge of our estuaries is also a straight-up Venetian delicacy.
It's a fishery that represent the lagoon of Venice, you know.
Right, so it's like when you come to Venice, that's a thing you have to do.
The most specific, there's nothing more Venetian.
Marissa's friend got her in touch with Paolo, and she went to visit his family. She and another lobsterman from Maine spent about a week in Venice last year.
They had a guest house that was right next to their house.
It was like a fishing exchange student program.
Paolo's mother cooked for us every day. It was just astounding. I've never eaten so much food in my life.
Every day they would wake up early.
We'd start the day out. We'd go out with Paolo in his boat, just like an open skiff.
Out on the Venetian lagoon, hauling in nets.
We would probably do that for 3 or 4 hours, and we would end up with about 800 pounds of green crabs.
There is something about the sound of a giant crate full of crabs, big, glistening, pincery ocean bugs crawling all over each other, that I find really unsettling. Once they get them onto the dock, the sorting begins. Well, actually.
We'd actually break for lunch and we'd have like a 2.5 hour long lunch. And then we would
Because Italy.
Because, yes, yeah. And, you know, at lunch, of course, everyone's like drinking Prosecco. And that was different for me. I was like, oh, it's nap time. It's not time to go back to work.
Okay, now the sorting begins.
Can I just point out, it's kind of funny how you use the crab's leg to point.
Well, it's a natural pointer.
It almost feels like the crab's like betraying itself.
This is where science has not caught up to tradition. Gabby Brandt, the careful scientist from the start of the story, caught 50 crabs, took many high-definition photos of them, 80% molted, but she couldn't detect any sign that distinguished the ones that were about to molt from the others.
I don't think I'm any good at this.
And generally speaking, that's what happens to people who are new to sorting crabs, is what happened to Marissa over in Italy.
We would stand around the sorting table with them, and we would pick crabs out and show them to them, you know, and they would just shake their head no.
Even after Paolo and his father had explained what to look for, the incredibly slight dark rings around the belly scales of the crabs that are about to molt, the puffy rear end that signaled water was getting inside the crab's shell as the plates spread and split, the sluggish behavior as the crab gets weaker before it sheds its carapace.
And it was just again and again and again. No, no, no.
After a week of doing this, after seeing tens of thousands of pounds of crabs, after an internship with the masters of spotting crabs about to molt.
Then that it happened that she showed me the crabs and I said, yes, another one, yes. But after she gave me a completely wrong crab, so I realized that she hadn't understood.
Meanwhile, Marissa says that Paolo, who learned from his father, and Paolo's father, who learned from his grandfather...
They're doing it, like, supersonic speed compared to us. So they'll dump, you know, 100 pounds at a time on the sorting table, and they don't even need to look at the crabs. I mean, most of them, they're just pushing, and discarding. And once in a while, they'll look at a crab from the back of it. They won't even turn it over, which is, I mean, we're looking at the underside of the crab to figure out the premolts. They'll just look at the top carapace side of the crab and pull it, and they'll know.
Wait, how do they know?
They're just that good. And I mean, that's what they told us, you know. It's the easiest to learn looking at the underside of the crab. Those are the easiest signs to learn. But if you get really good at that, you start seeing other signs. You start to see that there's other things about the crab that are changing. And so they're so good that they don't even need to really look at the crab. They just see it in the pile of other crabs, and it's different to them somehow, and they just pull it out and throw it aside.
It's like wizardry.
It is. It's crazy.
You might have thought that you were signing on for a story about delicious soft-shell crab po' boys, but the truth is that this is a story about the limits of science. And let me just say right here, I'm a big fan of the scientific method. I love to read about experimental design, about what the results of a study can and can't tell us, about what areas need more study, but science has some big blind spots. For instance, the fact that scientists mostly hang out with other scientists and not, say, Mediterranean fishers.
Green crabs have been in North America. They invaded in 1817. They've been here for more than 200 years. And scientists have been studying them for, you know, well over 100 years. But no one ever knew about this pre-molt indicator until we started connecting with these Phoenician fishermen.
Well, no American scientists knew.
It's hard to generalize, but it's almost like Western science is not quite ready. Like the fact that it took us from 1817 until 2018 to be like, oh, maybe we should ask these people who've been working with them for like hundreds of years.
Absolutely. And it's interesting too, because there was disagreement amongst Paolo and his father and his brother-in-law. So like, even amongst them, they're sometimes looking for different things. So I think, yeah, there's definitely a part of it that is it's sort of like a gut feeling almost, and like we can't rely on that in science, right? So I think that's part of the reason why, you know, there hasn't really been any major scientific breakthroughs on that front.
centuries-old, traditional ways of doing things are often results of generations of experimentation. How did the first Venetian crabbers figure out which green crabs were about to molt? I can only speculate, but I can tell you it wasn't through high-resolution cameras and computer analysis. They must have had to catch a lot of crabs, hold on to a lot of them, watch carefully every day, turning them over and over in their hands, fishing season after fishing season. Hundreds of fishers, without phones or television to distract them, spending years on the water observing hundreds of thousands of crabs. Then they showed their children, who showed their children. How could a couple people in a lab compete with centuries of data like that? One can take this idea too far. I'm not one who's going to argue that the old ways are always better, but I think it's pretty fair to say, and I think science has begun to recognize, that there are vast stores of discoveries that we could tap into if science started to take a closer look at traditions and ancient skills. Paolo has created an 11-page guide to crab molting, but even he says you really can't learn except by sorting crabs side by side with an expert. So for this to work in Maine, somehow this particular skill will have to make its way across the Atlantic. And if it does, it just might launch a new industry.
Can you give me your name? Chris James.
This is the lobster man who went to visit Venice with Marissa and Paolo.
You went to Venice?
Oh yeah.
How was that?
It was amazing. It was different. But it was a great trip. Learned a lot. And now I'm doing it here.
When we stood around the sorting table in Maine, Chris had a little bit of that Italian wizardry that Marissa described.
Let's see, it's like a
like the
dark,
ring around the scale.
The very end of it.
Yeah.
All the way up through, and they're starting to fade. He really doesn't have a lot of strength in his arm and his claws. He's slowing down.
This spring is the first time he's tried to sell the crabs. The day I met him, Chris said he had about 30 back at his place that he had successfully identified as pre-molt and that had, in fact, shed their shell once he separated them into their little crab condos.
It's a lot to it.
Yeah.
But those are just kind of some of the...
After, it's like you have to see like 600 crabs before you can start to tell?
A lot more than that. It's probably been like 20,000 pounds, it seems like, to really start to really focus in on what's good and what's not.
Chris took his soft shells to a high-end restaurant later that day, and he texted me after meeting with the chef. He told me the crabs sold for $30 a pound. And they told him to bring back more as soon as he had them.
That's it for Green Crabs and Word of Mouth this week, as well as our deep dive into the state budget. We love to talk about the federal government as much as anybody does. But in a country of 50 unique states, some of the biggest, weirdest, sometimes brightest ideas happen in state governments. And that's why we're going local. Civics 101 New Hampshire is a series exploring the government of our lovely, rambunctious home state. Producers Jackie Helbert, Ben Henry, and Daniela Ali knock on the doors of important people, hang out in the parking lots, and try to decipher how local democracy actually works. If you have a question about how our state government works, ask us. Find us online at civics101podcast.org. This week's show was produced by Ben Henry, Jackie Helbert, Daniela Ali, Sam Evans-Brown, and me. Music in this episode from Poddington Bear and Blue Dot Sessions. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
There wouldn't be a United States if it weren't for New Hampshire.
Why do you say that?
Okay. New Hampshire was the 9th state to ratify the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. You need 2/3, so that was 2/3. So there wouldn't be. Now, Delaware would make the same argument. They were first, but we don't argue with them. We just say there wouldn't be a United States if it weren't for the New Hampshire ratifying the U.S. Constitution.
Okay. Another claim to fame for New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, this is the oldest institution of its type in the country. The state, New Hampshire State Library dates from 1717. And just as important, and perhaps more important to a lot of people, would be that the first public library in the United States was, people are going to say Boston, people say Philadelphia, Peterborough, New Hampshire, an actual public library.